we're back in business, maybe. We'll see how long this bulb lasts. Like I said, it looks like it was from the 1960s or something, but hope it doesn't explode. All right, now, talking about the Beatles, and we were going to start going through some of the characters. We already talked about some of the introductory stuff and the four suborders and stuff, but we'll go over that a little bit more. Looking at characters, as we've seen, like in the cockroaches, some families, the head's not visible from above. We say it's concealed, so the pronotum may cover the head up. Remember, the cockroaches, the pronotum. Mm-hmm. So that may be something you'll have to look at. The antennae can vary quite a bit. Usually, in most families, it's 11 segmented, but as we'll see, like in scarabs, it'll be have fewer segments. But there's also many different kinds of antennae. And so if you're not confident on recognizing the different antennal types, you may want to review that. There'll be different kinds of club-type antennae, whether they're clavate or capitate. And even that, they'll have can have symmetrical clubs or asymmetrical clubs. You have an idea what an asymmetrical club would look like? You could have segments coming out here like this, and a normal club, you know, the segment would be something like this. You can have asymmetrical where the antenna's coming here, the next segment wouldn't be expanded on one side, but would be on the other.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
So it's an asymmetrical club, and it can really get pretty drastic where the segment would come out like this. Well, I should have started down lower to give myself room. But some of the segments may be almost plate-like.
That's also considered a club.
It's kind of an asymmetrical club, but now we're getting into like lamellate. Or, well, flabellate or lamellate when it's long plate-like segments like that. Some of them will have elbowed antennae called geniculate. There's some feathery antennal types. You know what? Feathery, real big feathery ones. Or just, it's probably too easy. It's plumose. Yeah. So, lots of different variations on the antennae and that, and so you may want to familiarize yourself with some of that. The eyes may be, the compound eyes may be entire or they may be emarginate. Emarginate just simply means it's got a notch in it. So you'll see in some families, like the cerambycids, on the head, the antennae will actually leave the come off the head, and the eye kind of encircles around it, and it's got a big notch in it as it's going around the base of the antennae. So those are emarginate eyes. Palps, certain families you'll have to look at the palps on the mouth parts. There's labial palps and maxillary palps. And the relative lengths of some of those, as we'll see maybe yet today, the two of the common aquatic families, the Dyticidae and the Hydrophilidae, the length of the antennae and the length of the maxillary palps varies, and so you'll have to look at that. If they refer to the mentum, just in review, that's the distal part of the labium. You can see it on the right-hand side of this Order of Coleoptera handout, but it's labeled there as the mentum. This one here's got kind of a indentation or notch anteriorly. Sometimes you'll have to look and see whether that front margin is entire or whether it has a notch in it. Some families have the head drawn out into a more or less snout-like structure, the weevils and things like that. And what they'll talk about when we get to those families, those are towards the end of the Coleoptera, but whether the gular sutures are fused or not. And what we're talking about, the underneath side of the head, you can see this structure in the middle labeled gula. On each side of it is a suture. Those are between the gula and the gina there, are the gular sutures. And what happens is the gula gets smaller and smaller, narrower and narrower, until it's not there anymore. You just have a suture right down the middle. And they say the gular sutures are fused. They're now just forming one suture down the middle. And we see that in the weevils, the Curculionidae. Kind of looking at the characters of the thorax, again, like we've seen in the Hemiptera, sometimes they'll talk about the lateral margins of the pronotum being margined or rounded. Again, if it's margined, the top and the bottom come together and form a sharp ridge laterally. Rounded, it just goes from the top around to the bottom nice and smoothly. Usually you can see a small scutellum. Again, it's a triangular shape. Sometimes it's indented anteriorly, so it looks more heart-shaped, but it would be there right behind the pronotum at the base of the elytra. When we separate some of the suborders, in that we talk about some sutures on the underneath side. The first one's called the notopleural suture. And it is the suture that separates the pronotum from the propleura. Pronotum's on top, right? And the propleura is lateral. And what we're talking about on this right-hand side would be this suture right here. And so that would be the notopleural suture. It's kind of out there laterally near the edge of the pronotum. You can see the edge of the pronotum, and then just inside the edge there's this suture called the notopleural suture. Some of the suborders have a notopleural suture, and some, notably the polyphaga, does not have a notopleural suture. There's also another suture under there called the prosternal suture. It's the one who separates the propleura from the prosternum. And so, I'll draw it on the other side, but it would be where this kind of dotted line is the prosternal suture. So again, the plate on the very underneath side, in the middle, is the prosternum, and the lateral plates are the part of the propleura. And so this is the suture that separates the prosternum from the propleura. The prosternum may be talked about as being lobed. When they say lobed, they're talking about right in this picture, this anterior margin goes straight on it. It's kind of straight, that anterior margin, but it might be lobed, meaning it's produced upwards. So a lobe prosternum would be more like there. I'm putting on as a green line. But also, in subfamilies, that prosternum is produced posteriorly between the coccyx. You see here, see how the prosternum is produced posteriorly? Some of it. Times it's pretty noticeable. It's an important character, like the click beetles. That's actually what sticks in a little cavity and causes it to make that clicking noise when it disengages it. They'll talk about the front coxal cavities being open or closed. It's kind of like the cells in the wing, whether they're open or closed. If they're closed, the two coccyx And that would be the two cocci. Well, that prosternum actually comes all the way. Oops, I didn't draw it very good. So my eyes aren't very good. But comes all the way around those two cocci. So directly behind the prococci is still the prosternum. Whereas if it's open, you'd have those two cocci, and the prosternum might be something like this. So directly behind the cocci would be the mesosternum. The prosternum doesn't completely enclose those cocci. So front coxal cavities close, sclerites of prothorax extend around front cocci. Front coxal cavities open behind, when the sclerite immediately behind the front cocci is the sclerite of the mesothorax. That's open and closed. Just like the wings cells, like I said, if they're open wing cells, they're on the margin. They're not completely enclosed by wing. If they're open, then they're on the margin.
So our example up here is a closed procoxy.
It is hard to tell. Because this, to me, I would say this is open. Because here's the prosternum here. This here is the mesosternum.
See? I can't see what I did. Oh, up here.
But yeah, here's the coxal cavity. And we're directly behind it. It's part of the mesosternum. The prosternum doesn't... It extends down here, but it doesn't completely enclose it.
So it's considered open if it doesn't completely enclose it. Mm-hmm.
Going on to the metathorax, sometimes they talk about a transverse suture. Transverse usually is going across, so but it would be like a suture going across here, across the metasternum. So metasternum with or without a transverse suture located in front of the hind cocci. They may talk about the metepisternum. It's labeled on here, but it's one of these lateral sclerites, kind of between the middle and hind legs. So again, if they talk about the metepisternum, that's what we're... I mean, of course, there's lots of parts on here. I was just pointing out some that are used in the keys and that if you read that, that's what they're going for. The cocci themselves can be a lot of different shapes and position. They talk about the cocci being globose. Globose would be just almost like a ball shape. They only project down a little bit eventually, so rounded. Talk about cocci, they're transverse. There's some families that have the cocci, especially the hind cocci, really flat and plate-like. We'll see it in one of the aquatic groups, some of the aquatic groups, the ditycids and the helipilids have flattened out cocci. They don't look like cocci hardly at all. They'll talk about cocci sometimes being prominent. They're kind of more cone shape and project ventrally very distinctly and noticeably. They'll talk about whether the cocci are contiguous or not, and that's their placement. If they're contiguous, they're right next to each other, essentially touching each other. If they're not contiguous, they're farther apart.
So the cocci refers to procoxa, mesococcia, and metacoxa?
Yeah, and most of these were probably referring to the hind cocci as the ones they look at mostly, but these terms could apply to any of them, I would think. This is where also, and we talked about it earlier, but in the beetles, they rely a lot on tarsal formulas. So I'll give out tarsal formulas quite frequently. there are some general rules, which we'll go over, that kind of makes it, I mean, this can at first seem kind of overwhelming to have to, oh, this family has 555, but that one only has 554, and this one only has 333, to remember tarsal formulas for everything. But there are some general rules that work for most things, so it's not like having to memorize the tarsal formula for every family. If you can remember the general rules, then it becomes a lot easier. But in most beetles, it is 555. When we get to some families, especially in the Tenebrionoidea, it's only 554. 555, we call that, what do we call that? We call that kind of whole.
555 is homo.
Pardon?
Homo something.
Well, if they're not all the same, we call that heteromeris. Hetero meaning like difference. In the Heteroptera, that there's a difference. The problem is sometimes it's not always easy to see, but there can be, like I said, 555, there can be 554, there can be 444, and there can be 333. But you'll see sometimes the hedge, it'll say something like the tarsi are apparently 444. And what they're getting at is it's really 555, but one of them's really tiny and hard to see. Mm-hmm. And the same thing, apparently 333, but it's really 444 with one really small. And sometimes it's one tarsa that's real small, and sometimes it's a different one. So, but that's what they'll refer to when they see that. They'll say actually three-segmented or apparently three-segmented. And if it's 444, let's see, if it's 555, we call that pentameris. There could be the tetrameris for 444. They said there'll be all different varieties. Sometimes 333, apparently 333 with the second one very small. And sometimes the front parts of one tarsal segment will be kind of lobed forwards or outwards distally. And there'll be a little tiny segment between those lobes. That what kind of sometimes makes it really hard to see. Probably the easiest thing to do, because I don't have a lot of room on here, is just to write on the whiteboard these generalized rules. So, on the tarsal formula, and right now you won't know these superfamilies and stuff, or things I'm talking about, but as we go through, it'll become more apparent. But one of the generalized rules, the Cucujoidea, is 444, except the coccinellidae. Is 333. Again, Cucujoidea probably doesn't ring a bell. There's a family called Cucujidae, and it'll become more apparent. But you ought to know what the coccinellidae is.
Coccinellidae.
I unfortunately can't remember.
Ladybugs.
Lady beetles. So
that's why he was
Cucujoidea, 444, except for the lady beetles, or 333. Mm-hmm. The Chrysomeloidea and Curculionoidea. Are 444. So, families related to the Chrysomelids, the leaf beetles, and the things that are the weevils and relatives are 444. As I mentioned just a minute ago, the tenebrionoidea. R554. And then everything else is 555 except some small and rare families.
Quick question. So the formula refers to the tarsal segments excluding the tarsal claws, correct?
Right. So, like I said, all the ton of families. And we'll give tarsal formulas for a lot of them. And so, you know, it seems like it'd be overwhelming to remember that tarsal formula for everything. But generally, these rules, and only four of them, will cover most of the families. Once we learn what's in the Cupidoidea, 444, except for the lady beetles, is 333. And then when we learn what's in the Chrysomeloidea and Curculinoidea, those are all 444. The tenebrionoidea are all 554, and then everything else is usually 555, except that there's some small families or rare families that may be exceptional. So, all right, back to the talking about the tarsal claws, there can be some differences there in the tarsal claws, whether they may be asymmetrical, meaning one claw may be larger than the other claw. They may have teeth on the claws or not have teeth. So it could be simple, tooth, cleft, pectinate. The elytra. Sometimes they'll talk about the elytra being striate or having striae. Those are just kind of grooves going the length of the elytra. They may talk about the elytra being pubescent or not. And that essentially is whether it's got hairs on them. Be kind of hairy elytra or not. Bostrichids, dermestids have hairy elytra. Now, the first segment of the abdomen, moving on to the abdomen, the first segment of the abdomen helps us separate the two larger suborders. In the ataphaga, the hind coccyx extend backwards and actually divide the first abdominal segment into two halves. And so that's what you see here. Here's one of the coccyx. On the other side, they've taken the coccyx out, but you can see the cavity. Mm-hmm. But you can see segment one of the abdomen does not go all the way across. You can see it over here, and you can see it over here, but those hind coccyx divide the first abdominal segment into two parts.
So the other one probably doesn't do that, right?
The other one doesn't do that. The first segment could draw in a new line, but it would go all the way across. And you can see at least some of the first abdominal segment all the way across. So ataphaga, hind coccyx extend backwards and bisects the first abdominal sternum, so that consists of two lateral pieces separated by the hind coccyx. Polyphaga, the hind coccyx extend backward at different distances in different groups, but first abdominal segment is never completely divided, and its posterior edge extends completely across the body. Now, just caution you that again, in some families, the coccyx themselves are very large and flattened and plate-like, And you may think that that's part of the abdomen, but it's not. It's the coccyx. But we'll point that out when we get to it. The number of segments that you can see sometimes is important. You can't always see or as the same number of abdominal segments. And in some groups, like the Buprestidae, the first two segments are essentially fused together. You can see the suture between them is not near as distinct as it is on some of the others. Also, you know, should have mentioned it with the elytra. The length of the elytra will be important too. There are some beetle groups where the elytra is quite short and leaves some of the abdominal segments exposed from above. And so we'll talk about that in some. Now, there's a term called the pygidium. And I, on this, I always just cover this in and with an arrow saying it's the pygidium. Truthfully, the pygidium is the dorsal. That's a ventral view. But the pygidium is essentially the last abdominal segment that sometimes protrudes beyond the end of the abdomen. So pygidium, the last dorsal segment of the abdomen, the last abdominal turgon, sometimes exposed beyond the tips of the elytra. So that's some of the characters that will be talked about as we go along here. Mm-hmm. Now, as we mentioned, the order Coleoptera can be divided into four suborders. There's the Archostomata. Here is one suborder. We already listed these others off, but there's the Myxophaga, the Ataphaga, and the Polyphaga. The first two, Archostomata and Myxophaga, like I said, they're very small, only contain a few families. Archostomata means ancient stem, and it's considered to be quite primitive. In the Archostomata, there are no notopleural sutures. And one of the characteristics of this suborder is that the wings, the hind wings, when they're at rest, actually roll up in a spiral. They're not folded flat over the back like in most other groups. They're kind of in there and kind of in a spiral underneath the hem elytra. Their tarsal formula is 555. There are some fossil species that seem to be intermediate between this group and the Neuroptera. And we'll see some other things later on that some of the aquatic groups, the immatures, of some of the beetle families look very Neuroptera-like, showing how these two orders are related. As I said, in the Archostomata, there are only three families in this suborder. Your text only covers two in the New World. One of them, the Omatidae, is only in the Old World. There's only one Eastern North American species in the Micromalthidae. None of these families we require. The only one that sometimes you run across, and I have caught it in the South, is this Cupetidae. And so we provided a handout on this group. But the Cupetids, again, are a little bit more common, but it's still fairly rare. It doesn't occur here in North Dakota. There's only five species in the U.S. Common name is reticulated beetles because the elytra are kind of reticulated. The prosternum protrudes between the front coccyx, kind of like it does in the click beetles and that. But anyway, just you should be aware of this small suborder, the Archostomata, and probably the main character is that the hind wings are in a spiral up underneath the elytra when at rest. Now, I don't think I have even a handout. The myxophagia, you know what the order name myxophagia means?
Well, phagia, eat.
Yeah.
Myxo. How'd you I honestly don't know.
Myxo means slime. How would you like to be commonly slime called the eater? Slime eater? So the name myxophagia derives as follows. Myxo means slime, phagia means eater. So these are the slime eaters. And they do kind of feed on algae and that sort of thing. Here the notopleural sutures are present, but the hind cocci are not fused to the abdomen. We'll see that in the next one, the ataphaga, the hind cocci are fused to the abdomen.
Oh.
Here, these are kind of intermediate. The hind wings basically are flattened or folded under the elytra, but the apices, the end of the hind wings, are spiral. Mm-hmm. So they're not spiral all the way throughout like in the archostomata, but they're flattened basally and spiral distally.
Some of them look like they have a little tail of some kind. I think I saw one of these. I thought it was a larva.
Oh.
Or something along those lines that have red spots on it. And
the tarsal formula is 333 in the myxophagia. Mm-hmm. My notes say there's only, this suborder contains only four small families, only two of which are known in North America. The Hydroscaphidae occurs along margins of sluggish streams and springs. Microsporidae occur in wet gravel along streams. Mm. Both families apparently feed on algae. But again, we don't require any families. So now we go to the ataphaga. And ataphaga, again, does not have a huge number of families, but it does have a couple or several that are quite common. And the first one is the Carabidae, lots of carabids. And so this is a fairly large family. The ataphaga itself literally means gluttonous. In the ataphaga in general, the hind cocci are fused to the abdomen, and they do divide that first abdominal segment into two, as we already mentioned. Here's another on this carabid handout. You can see a good picture of that, that the first abdominal segment is completely divided into two parts. Yeah, that's a character of this whole suborder. The tarsal formula is 555. The antennae in this suborder are usually filiform, except as we'll see in one family, the Gyrinidae. Do you guys know the Gyrinidae?
They have the eyes set into two sets of
Yeah, we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. But the antennae on the Gyrinidae are very short and stout antennae. They're not long and filiform like in the other families. But yeah, they're the whirligig beetles. And we'll talk about the eye thing that you mentioned. Notopleural sutures are present, but they're not always easy to see. Wings are folded normally when at rest. Again, not a lot of families, but fairly or several common. The first family we'll talk about in the ataphaga is the Carabidae. Mm-hmm. The Carabidae, one of the characters that you can help you recognize it is what we call a displaced trochanter. And you can see it right here in that bottom center figure again. But the trochanter sometimes is offset. In fact, it almost looks like in some species the femora will actually meet the cocci, that the trochanter is off to the side. But it'll always be kind of displaced and kind of weird looking. It's not just right in line with the femur and the coxa.
And that's every Is that every carabidae or?
All the carabidae should have that, yeah.
Okay. That makes that puts the tiger beetle in there. Okay.
And pretty much only the carabidae have that, although there may be some smaller, rare families that may have displaced trochanters. But essentially, if it's got a displaced trochanter, you know you've got a carabid. Now, the carabidae, this family has, well, it's one of the larger families, too. It's got a lot of species. See. Common names, ground beetles. For most of them, the one group are called tiger beetles. That's what I was leading up to. There's about 20,000 species of carabids, 26 in North America. It is one of the larger families, third largest family of beetles. And what I was getting to is it's gotten larger in recent years. Some of these, for example, this one here, that's round one, it's Omophron. Mm-hmm. When I went through taxonomy, it was a separate family, the Omophronidae. But it's been rolled into this family. It's now still a subfamily, the Omophroninae. And then, as we'll get to in the next handout, the tiger beetles used to be its own family, the Cicindelidae. But now they're a subfamily of the carabids. As I said, the most characteristic feature of the family is the displaced trochanters. You can, if you... Well, to me, tiger beetles just look different carabids than carabids, but or the ground beetles. Tiger beetles look different than the ground beetles, so they're all carabids. But the way you can kind of tell them apart, this picture in the center of the carabid ones, you can see the clypeus right here. Mm-hmm. It doesn't extend way laterally. It ends before it gets to the lateral margin of the head. Yeah. So the antennae look like they're right between the eyes and the mandibles, where they come off.
Okay.
Whereas in the tiger beetles, this clypeus is enlarged and extends much more laterally. Mm-hmm. And so now the antennae look like they come off between the eyes and the clypeus. Mm. So there is a difference between the two groups, where the antennae kind of relationship between the antennae, the eyes, and the clypeus. Back to the first one, just to talk about ground beetles. They are called ground beetles because most of them are on the ground. There's a few that get up into trees and that. This one clear over to the left, it's labeled fiery searcher. There's also one called the fiery hunter, and what's the other one? There's one that's, I had that in my notes too, and it's going to blank on what it is. Species in genus Calosoma have been introduced for biocontrol projects aimed at gypsy moth larvae. They are larger and called caterpillar hunters. That's the name I was thinking of. That one clear over there, and that fiery searcher, they're really pretty. They're metallic green or blues, and quite large, but they'll be up in the trees more, again, you may be used as biocontrol against gypsy moths. And a lot of different habits. Most of them are predatory, but there are a few that are phytophagous. This one down in the lower, towards the lower right-hand corner, is called seed corn beetle. And it is more of a phytophagous one, can be a pest. The one up in the upper right towards, you can see it has an elongate head. It actually has got an elongate head because it feeds on snails. It can stick its head up into the snail shell and get to the snail.
So cool.
Yeah, a lot of different cool habits. This picture towards the left, you can see that side picture.
Uh-huh.
It's supposed to be illustrating the bombardier beetle.
Yeah.
That they can mix some chemicals in its rectum and it causes an explosive, fiery explosion and squirt out this hot caustic liquid. They can even aim at what they want to hit.
They were actually, I remember hearing that they were actually pretty accurate with relative range.
Yeah.
When it comes to, like, if they wanted to get something off their front leg, they could orient themselves to get, like, an ant off their front leg or something on their front leg off their front leg.
Yep, probably so. Yep. So what else? Maybe that's those on that one. Like I said, the next handout is on the tiger beetles. You can see the prints a little bit different. I think when we put these handouts originally together, we had this as a separate family, but we had to make some changes so we could roll it into the Carabidae, and now it's the Cicindelinae. The thing is, they look different. To me, it's a nice group, but apparently in the tropics and in some places, there are some species that are intermediate between the two. They don't quite know whether they would belong in the Carabids or the Cicindelids, and so it's kind of the connecting link. But you guys, I know both of you were chasing tiger beetles, and so it's an interesting group. It is a favorite group for collectors. Around here we had actually a long time ago somebody donated a huge tiger beetle collection, so we've got lots in our museum collection and that. So again, as you know, they seem to prefer more sandy habitats, sand dunes and things like that around water. Those sandy roads that we were walking on at Muir Pool, and that's where you often would find them. Pardon?
Are those larvae off to the right?
Yep. And they, I was looking to see if I had a description of it in my notes, but just going off the top of my head, I believe they form like burrows in the ground. They'll be in little tube-like, and they'll catch things as they walk by or fall into their burrows.
Antlions?
That's kind of like antlions. Antlions, well, these aren't antlions. Antlions are in the Neuroptera. And we'll, you know, get to those. But yeah, kind of a similar thing. They make little conical pits that things could fall in. This is more of a, I think, like a tube-like thing that they lay and wade in. So see, today I think we will. Well, we'll see. There's another handout on immatures of Carabids. The next family is the Gyrinidae that we've already mentioned. This one, I mean, it is still in the Ataphaga, but this doesn't have the long filiform antennae. The antennae are more short and stout. You can see them on this bottom figure, the ventral surface. You can see the antennae there, just real short. As Aaron was saying, these have the head dividing the eyes into two halves, and two of them are dorsal and two of them are ventral. So it looks like it has four compound eyes, but it doesn't. It's the head that is expanded around and divided it. Again, this Dr. Folkerts that I've talked about that was at Auburn University, he discovered a species in Alabama where that division wasn't complete. And so he in this species down there, you could see that the top eyes, the dorsal eyes, and the ventral eyes were actually connected together all as one unit. So essentially, it's all, they still only have two compound eyes, but the head divides it into each one into two parts. So compound eyes are divided by the edge of the head, so it appears that they have four, two dorsal and two ventral, but there's this species down south. Antennae are short and stout. These swim on the surface of the water, often in large groups. You can see them, they'll be just kind of slowly skating around on top of the surface together, and then you go to disturb them, and next thing you know, they're going everywhere. Just the chaos makes it probably hard for a predator to capture them. And they don't usually dive underwater, but they can dive and go underwater even. So they are well adapted for swimming. Middle and hind legs move in synchrony. What I mean by that is when they swim, both middle legs go at one time, both hind legs. And same thing in the the Ditycids, which I think we talk about next, we got another one before that, but they move their legs in synchrony too. When we get to the Hydrophilids, which is in the next suborder, Polyphaga, but very similar, but yeah, they'll do one leg and then the other, so they're not in synchrony. They alternate. These are mostly scavengers, feeding on insects that fall in the water. The larvae are predaceous. There's only two common genera in the U.S. The Gyrinus are small, so these over here are fairly small species, where Dinutes are larger. These can emit a foul substance too. Even putting them in vials of alcohol. They're kind of yucky in a kill jar, but then you also put them in a vial of alcohol, they'll emit a milky looking, and so it kind of makes the alcohol look yucky in that also. So anyway, but they do occur around here. I've seen them over there at the Moorhead Science Center. The next family is the Polyplidae, which I believe these occur around here, but they're not very common. This is a little aquatic group. These are fairly small. They're kind of got a distinctive shape. They're pear-shaped, and in the head just looks like it's kind of small for the rest of the body. But this is a group where the hind coccyx are very large and plate-like. See the picture down at the very lower left? That's not the abdominal segment you see there. They're marked CX, but those are the coccyx. Very large and flat. And they're these large flat coccyx, that's where they can go to the surface and get a bubble of water, and they actually trap the bubble of air. You can get a bubble of air. They can trap that bubble of air under those hind coccyx. So it's kind of what holds the bubble that they can breathe from. Again, they're small, 2.5 to 4.5 millimeters, usually yellowish or brownish with the black spots. My story with Polyplidae, they were fairly common in Louisiana, and the professor that I worked for there at the insect museum, and this is before I got there, but she'd had a student who was working on the taxonomy of these Polyplidae, and so he'd borrowed specimens from museums all over the country. And partway into his project, he and this professor, was a woman, Joan Chapin, had a falling out and didn't like each other, and it all culminated with him going after her. She had to lock herself in her office with him pounding on the door to try to get in to her, and she called one of the male professors in the department who had to come in, up and drag this student out of there. So he left the university, but he took all these specimens with him that he'd borrowed from all around the country and didn't ever return them. And of course, all these other universities were pretty upset at us, at Louisiana State. And so this professor, to try to make it right, she put out the word that whenever we went out collecting, doing aquatic collecting, we should make a special effort to collect Polyplidae, so that she at least could send them specimens from our area and try to make it right a little bit. So anyway, we tried to collect a lot of Polyplidae when we were down there.
With the Polyplidae, do they store the air bubble in the coccyx between the sternites?
Yeah, I believe so. They carry the oxygen they need for respiration under the coccyx. Yeah. Do this family, we might actually do another one because it's even after this one would be a good stopping point. We'd have the autophagy done. But also, this family and the next one are two that you're likely to confuse. So it might still be good to do this one and just at least start the polyphagy. But again, this is another aquatic family, the Dytisidae. This is one of the more common aquatic families. When you guys are getting aquatic beetles, mm-hmm. most of them will be either Dytisids or hydrophilids.
I just thought I saw a way to tell the difference.
Well, they're in two different suborders. So again, the hindcoxy should divide the first abdominal segment in this one, and it doesn't in the hydrophilids. Mm-hmm. But there are better ways to easier ways to separate these two families. First off, notice in this family, the antennae are relatively long and filiform. Okay, you can see the antennae fairly easily. When we get to the hydrophilidae, you'll see that the antennae are much shorter. In this family, the antennae are fairly long, and you can't see the maxillary palps, and just from normal looking down on it here. When we get to the hydrophilidae, the antennae are shorter, but the maxillary palps are quite long and held out in front of the head. In fact, in the hydrophilids, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but the hydrophilids, those antennae, often help hold a bubble of water underneath the body. They're involved with holding the bubble in place, and the maxillary palps are kind of held out in front of the head and have maybe taken over some of the sensory function that normally you'd find in the antennae. So anyway, back to the Dytisids though. They have about 4,000 species worldwide. There's 500 in North America. Again, Dytisids have very long filiform antennae and short maxillary palps. Some species do have a large hind coxy, and it does divide that first abdominal segment into two. These are aquatic, mostly predaceous insects. You can see they're well built for swimming and going through the water. You can see the kind of the natatorial hind legs, kind of large oar-like legs with long hairs on them. But they're also very streamlined. You can just see the body, how it's built to go through the water fairly easily. There can be some quite large species, some that are large enough to maybe attack small fish and things like that, not just other insects. On the other hand, there's some that are quite tiny. There's some in the range of 1 to 2 millimeters that are kind of rare because they can go right through the netting of your nets. They're that tiny. The males of some species have kind of suction cups, structures on the front tarsi. Can't really see them in here, but they'll have kind of a suction cup structure on the front tarsi that's used to actually hold on to the female during mating. As I said, they resemble the hydrophilidae, and this is the family you most likely confuse them with, but the antennal and maxillary palp structure should help. Coxal characters should help. There's some biological differences. This group, the Dytisids, will get a bubble of air, but they keep it under their elytra, whereas the hydrophilids keep it on the underneath side of their body. And as I already mentioned, when these swim, they move their legs simultaneously or in synchrony, whereas the hydrophilids alternate one leg and then the other. This is another one of the groups. You can see the immatures over to the right, but the mouth parts and the head structure looks very much like the Neuropterans. In fact, I sometimes have trouble telling if an immature is actually a Neuropteran or whether it's a Coleopteran. Like I said, that actually finishes the autophagy. But I'm going to go ahead and just talk about the polyphagy, at least do this one first family, because of how close it is or how it looks like with the Dytisids. But the polyphagy, poly means many, phaga means eating. So this is, these are eaters of many things. The big character is that the hind coccyx are not fused to the abdomen and they don't divide the first abdominal segment into two. This picture is showing, I hadn't really looked at it before, but it would almost look, I think this is part of the metasternum up here. So this is the first abdominal segment. And you can see it goes all the way across. The polyphaga in general do not have notopleural sutures. Remember, they were present in the ataphaga, but they were sometimes hard to see. The wings are folded over the backs normally when at rest. Tarsal formula, and this, now we're in the group where it can vary greatly, where these general rules will help. Like I said, 90% of the species belong in the polyphaga. As we go through these families in the polyphaga, just because it makes it a little easier to split it up into smaller groups, we'll talk about some different superfamilies. The problem is the characters to separate superfamilies are kind of difficult, depend on wing venation and various things, and some of it's internal, like how many malpighian tubules they have. And so I'm not going to be really caring if we remember all the characters of the superfamilies. It's just a matter of convenience. So you're not got this mass of families. We can say, okay, we have these different groups that we can kind of work with. And so, starting in the polyphaga, the first superfamily is the Hydrophyloidea. And there's not very many families. Your textbook only contains three, and one of them is only a maybe. But we're still going to talk about the Hydrophyllidae and the Hysteridae in this superfamily. But mainly I wanted to go ahead and talk about the Hydrophyllidae, because it is the other more common aquatic group. And you should realize there are some other aquatic families. There's another family called the Noteridae, which look a lot like small Dytiscids, but they're just not very common in that. But the Hydrophyllidae, now you'll notice that, again, the antennae are much shorter, not long and filiform like we saw in the Dytiscids, but now look at the maxillary palps. They're long and held out in front of the head. One thing that often helps is quite a few species of hydrophyllids have this spine-like projection on the anterior or on the ventral part of the body. None of the Dytiscids have that. So if you see the big spine-like structure on the underneath side, you know you've got a hydrophyllid. Cool. If you don't have that spine, then you got to go the other characters, because there are hydrophyllids who don't have the spine. Understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you see the spine, you know you got a hydrophyllid. If you don't see a spine, then you got to look at the other characters, the antennae and the maxillary palps and some of the stuff to be sure.
So some hydrophyllids have a rudder, others don't.
Yeah.
Is that what that spine surface is like?
I don't know.
Well, no, it really doesn't move. It's just
there.
I don't know if it helps hold the air bubble or what it does. I don't think. It says the metasternum of many species is prolonged into a sharp spine. Yeah, I don't have anything on what the spine does or how, if it's got a function or not. So these are, again, well, I should say the aquatic species are very well adapted to swimming in the water. Look at the ones over on the right-hand side of this handout. They don't look very well adapted for swimming in water. And it's because they're not. They're terrestrial. So there are some terrestrial hydrophyllids. They think this is a secondary thing, that, you know, this is an aquatic group, and then some have adapted to living back on land again. And most of those that are terrestrial, like you see over on the right-hand side, are often associated with dung of animals, mammal dung. But hydrophyllids, oval, convex, Beetles, short clubbed antennae which lie beneath the head. Maxillary palps is long or longer than the antennae and often extend forward. Again, the metasternum of many species are prolonged backwards into this spine. Again, they're streamlined, well adapted for swimming. Aquatic species look like ditticids, but can be separated from that family by the shorter antennae and longer maxillary palps. These are primarily scavengers. They're predaceous as immatures. Again, those over to the right are terrestrial. Aquatic species have a hydrofuge of hairs to hold a bubble of water for breathing. Again, the antennae may help to hold the bubble of air on the ventral surface of the body. And it's possible that the maxillary palps have taken over some of the function of the antennae. The hydrophilids replenish their bubble by sticking their head out of the water. The ditticids replenish their bubble by sticking their hind end out of the water. So again, if you see them swimming in the water and see them stick their head out, you know you got a hydrophilid. If you see them stick their hind end out of the water, you know you got a ditticid. And again, these now swim with their legs asynchronous or alternating one than the other. Let's do one more family. That'll finish the hydrophilidia, and then we'll quit. The hysteroidia. Hysteroidia.
Yeah, there's the one.
Oh, you did get, you thought, one of those under in a dead log or something?
It just kind of sort of fell out. Stays. Yeah, hysteridae.
Yeah, hysterity. Some of these can be quite flattened, and that's because they are up under bark of dead trees and that. These are usually broad, oval beetles, often quite flat. Can be quite small, less than a millimeter. Usually shiny black. Often the elytra do not reach the end of the abdomen. So some of the abdomen will stick out beyond the apex of the elytra.
Are they still considered elytra and not hemielytra?
Yeah. Because they're not half and half. They're still uniform all the way. They just don't go all the way. So, the antennae are elbowed. See how they go out and then they bend pretty sharply forwards. Mm-hmm. So elbowed. The front tibia often have spines and things like that on them, kind of somewhat modified for digging or that. They're kind of fossorial. The tarsal formula in this family is 555. Again, these are often found in or near decaying organic matter, in dung, fungi, carrion, but they're often predaceous on other insects or other animals living in these materials. Flat species live under loose bark of stumps or logs. There's a few that are more elongate or cylindrical. You can see this one in the toward the right is more elongate and cylindrical shaped. Some of these live in the galleries of wood-boring beetles, or some live in ant nests, and they have all kinds of levels of getting along with the ants. Some of it's a hostile thing where they'll raid the ants and the ants will fight back, and some they kind of don't care about each other. And then there's some where the ants kind of almost take care of them and they get along just fine, almost like true guests of the ants. So, but anyway. But there, we'll stop with that. The next time, we'll start with the Staphylinoidea, the staphylinid beetles, and that. I guess that'll be tomorrow. So any questions on what we've covered today? again, you probably both have got carabids and cicindelids, and maybe have some ditycids or hydrophilids, and of course you've got the hysterid. So I will hit